Hi, this is Alex Letterman at Dawson Halsey in Washington, D.C. I love podcasts because they help me survive my long commute, and I love a podcast by a couple of colleagues who are helping me stay up to date with IP law. You're listening to IP Fridays. Thank you, Ralph and Ken.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of IP Fridays. Our names are Ken Suzanne and Rolf Clayson, and this is the podcast dedicated to intellectual property. It does not matter where you are from, in-house or private practice, novice or expert. We will help you stay up to date with current topics in the fields of trademarks, patents, design and copyright, discover useful tools, and much more.
Welcome to episode number 12. We currently have around 1,200 downloads of MP3 files. That means, hopefully, that 1,200 people listened to our show last month. So that makes us really happy. And if you like the show, you can subscribe on iTunes at www.ipfridays.com/iTunes, or you can listen to us on Stitcher. Stitcher is an app that runs on the iPhone or Android or on BlackBerry or even in some cars. I think Ford and BMW also support Stitcher. You can subscribe on Stitcher at www.ipfridays.com/Stitcher, ipfridays.com/Stitcher. And if you really like us, you can leave us a review either on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you find our podcast in any directory. We are listed in many, many directories. Today we have a special guest, Brian Brocade. He is a litigator in New York and handling mostly anti-counterfeiting cases. And we also tell you about Alibaba and their fake problem. But we will start this time with the interview. And Ken had the chance to interview Brian Brocade. So take it away.
Thank you, Rolf. I'm speaking to Brian Brocade of Gibney, Anthony & Flaherty in New York City. Brian is the head of Gibney, Anthony & Flaherty's Intellectual Property Practice Group. He has extensive experience in the application of intellectual property law and in investigation and enforcement procedures to combat the infringement and counterfeiting of trademarks and copyrights. Brian focuses on anti-counterfeiting and anti-piracy and handles all stages of civil anti-counterfeiting and infringement litigation. He also has had extensive involvement in state and federal criminal actions. Brian is also the treasurer, a member of the board of directors, and on the executive committee of the International Anti-Counterfeiting Coalition. He is also the treasurer of the New York Task Force, a coalition of brand owners affected by counterfeiting. And finally, Brian is also a member of the International Trademark Association, where he serves as a board member and is on the Anti-Counterfeiting Committee. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Ken. Thank you so much, and thanks for having me as your guest today.
Thank you, indeed. Brian, can you tell our listeners a little bit about your practice, and how long have you been battling the counterfeiters?
Well, it certainly doesn't seem this long, except when I look back and listen to your introduction like that. I guess I've been at this for a while.
Sure.
I actually started my IP practice in 1984. Which has happened to be the same year as the initial passages of the amendments to the Lanham Act, which codified seizures, and it was the 1984 Anti-Counterfeiting Act.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how long I've been doing it, and I really sort of grew up in the business. And our practice today has evolved into, I think, what you might call, on one side, a fairly traditional IP practice in terms of trademark clearance and registration, but also we have a true specialty on the enforcement side, not only in trademark copyright infringement, but specifically trademark counterfeiting and copyright piracy.
Yes, and I bet that's a big problem these days with the Internet, as popular as it is.
And that's been a huge change since I first started practicing, Ken.
Mm-hmm.
my initial lawsuits were against traditional brick-and-mortar counterfeiters, where you showed up with U.S. Marshals and you showed up with seizure orders, and you sought the physical seizure of counterfeit goods from fixed locations. But as you've already hinted, Ken, the Internet has changed the game. And it wasn't a gradual change either. Certainly found that once the Internet became as a popular way to communicate and then to convey goods and to advertise, as their want to do, the counterfeiters quickly caught on as to how to use the Internet as a tool to sell their wares.
Yes. Now, how would you say counterfeiters are different today as they were 10 or 20 years ago?
Okay. They're a lot more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. Counterfeiters today, of course, have taken full advantage of every advance in technology. And as a result, in terms of enforcement efforts, to stay one step ahead of the counterfeiters or even with the counterfeiters, you also have to quickly adapt your investigative and your enforcement methods, also using every bit of technology that you can muster. So I would say as a group, the counterfeiters today are much more organized, much more technologically advanced, and much more efficient in terms of how they go about their business. And as a result, I think the counterfeiting organizations have gotten larger and larger.
Mm-hmm.
And they're probably very profitable as a result.
Can you tell me about a recent victory you've had? I know you've been practicing for a long time, but I'm interested in a recent victory against counterfeiters in the U.S. or abroad. And what did it take to get that victory?
Ken, my most recent victory occurred in the Central District of Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
And that was I want to say that was probably about 6 or 7 months ago when we got a final judgment and injunction against a counterfeiter again an internet counterfeiter. But wasn't selling the so-called the run-of-the-mill Chinese knockoff watches. They were actually selling watches, genuine watches, that had been converted with non-genuine parts into a watch that was portrayed as a more expensive model.
Mm-hmm.
So these were altered watches, and I spent a good part of my career in the late 90s and the 2000s, pushing for decisions which basically said even when you have a product that starts out life as a genuine, and so the trademarks on the product are genuine, if that product has been altered to such an extent that it can no longer be called the original product, that product is counterfeit. And the reason we were so anxious to get that type of relief, Ken, was because we got all the enhanced remedies that you get under the Counterfeiting Act,
mm.
In terms of in terms of the defendant's profits and your costs and attorney's fees, and of course the possibility always of statutory damages. Because as you well know, Ken, if counterfeiters do everything well except keep books and records.
Sure. Is that a case reported out in the public?
I think it would. You could probably reach it on. You could probably access it on Lexis.
Okay.
The name of the case is Rolex Watch USA versus Melrose.
Okay.
Jewelers, Melrose Jewelers.
Mm-hmm.
And Central District of California. And if your listeners probe around the Ninth Circuit, Ken, they're going to see several Rolex cases, which beginning in the mid-1990s, which stand for that proposition that a genuine good, once it's altered to such an extent that it affects the quality and the functioning of the original product, is no longer the original product and is counterfeit, despite the presence of genuine marks on the product.
That's a great case to read. and something I'm sure our listeners will want to look at. You know, these days with money being tight, one question comes to mind in that if a company has a limited budget for legal, how could they still effectively monitor and enforce their trademarks in the marketplace, both on the internet and offline in the non-virtual world?
Well, that is a circumstance which exists probably more times than we think, and that is because you know, some companies that are, you know, of course, they're very creative and they develop a great product. And they developed a great trademark, and they put their product out there, and they advertise, and lo and behold, the next thing they know, they're being counterfeited, either brick and mortar or on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And but these are young companies; they haven't had years and years of enforcement. They haven't built up case law. They probably don't even have in-house counsel. The best way to go about that, Ken, for companies of this nature, is to, of course, they have to be vigilant. And so from in-house, they have to establish a so-called monitoring department, which is going to look at all the possible venues of the counterfeit products in terms of their own product.
Mm-hmm.
You know, be that brick and mortar, be that the internet. And they're going to have to first define their problem. They're going to have to first define where their own customers go and where they're, for the legitimate brand and where the customer for the legitimate brand might be encountering the counterfeit goods. And they should start there. They certainly can't do it all.
Sure.
But they have to start where it's most visible. And, you know, many companies, I think initially a certain level of excitement, that they've become popular enough to be counterfeited. But then, Ken, what happens is they realize the amount of resources they have to put into a counterfeiting program can sometimes significantly cut into the profits of that new company.
Sure.
So they have to start small and start selective. And I can't stress enough these young companies, these young brands, to become part of a coalition, to become part of an entity like the IACC or INTA, where they can share some of their problems with some of their peers and get some good knowledge as to what resources there are out there to affect the proper remedy to fight their problem.
For those listeners that are not familiar with those organizations, do you know the websites where people can go?
Yeah, absolutely. The ICC is IACC.org.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's INTA.org, I believe, for the interwebs.
Yeah.
That's excellent.
And your listeners should know, as you do, Ken, that if one of your clients' brands is suffering from counterfeiting, you start with those organizations as a great resource. Because there's a huge body of knowledge that exists in the membership of those organizations and in their existing programs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, as part of the internet, you know, social media is a very big piece of today's economy and marketing and advertising, and I assume counterfeiters have taken to it as well. What would you recommend for stopping counterfeiting problems that are on social media sites?
Well, Ken, you're exactly right. Social media has become very popular with the counterfeiters. They've managed to infiltrate deeply many of the social media sites that we're all familiar with on a daily basis, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, Instagram. And they quickly took to social media not as a forum in which to share ideas, but as a forum in which to sell their products. And again, I'm going to have to emphasize this concept of monitoring. The brand owner, the lawyer, has to set up a process whereby all the social media sites are regularly monitored to look for the sellers of counterfeit goods. Of course, it's very tricky because these social media sites, a lot of times there's trademark use from fans. There's trademark use from people who love the product. You have to be very careful not to alienate the consumer of the legitimate good.
That's right.
But truly focus on the people selling counterfeit goods. Establish great relationships, great alliances with, with the operators of these social media sites. They all have pretty responsive takedown programs where you can just send them notice as to a particular infringing problem, and they'll take that problem down.
Mm-hmm.
This concept of alliances, more and more, Ken, like with the eBays of the world and the Alibabas and the Taobaos, rather than treating these entities as a so-called adversary, because it's a marketplace for the sale of counterfeit goods, establish alliances, establish cooperation with these marketplace platforms, with the social media sites, because together it can significantly attack the problem of counterfeiting that might exist on any one of those mediums.
Yeah, that's well said. Is there anything that the government in the United States needs to be doing to tighten the laws or enforcement efforts, and what are your thoughts about overseas?
In terms of the U.S. government, I think all the laws in the United States are in place to effectively go after counterfeit goods, both at the state criminal level, the local criminal level, and the federal criminal level, and as well, of course, in terms of the civil remedies that are out there, primarily in the federal courts. I think all the laws are there. In terms of enforcement, with law enforcement, it requires a fair amount of education, a fair amount of educating law enforcement, such as U.S. Customs, as to your particular counterfeiting problem, and you set up contacts with all the enforcement agencies to make sure that they know where you are when they encounter a counterfeit good.
Mm-hmm.
So the trademark owner, the brand owner, the copyright holder has to be extremely vigilant in maintaining those law enforcement contacts to make sure they know you're out there.
Sure.
Because if they know you're out there and you've educated them as to the counterfeit version of the product that's out there, they will take action. In terms of overseas, I think for sure we've heard, I'll take China for example. What we've heard is that China has all the requisite laws that are required to effectively deter the manufacture of counterfeit goods. But, of course, enforcement over there, because of its very localized nature, continues to be a very big challenge. But certainly anything you can do from a lobbying standpoint, both in the U.S. and also abroad, to tighten laws, to address loopholes that might exist, every brand owner should be very active in that realm.
That's right. I agree 100% with that analysis. Brian, how can people reach you after they're listening to the podcast?
Well, let's see. I'm happy to share my email address.
Okay.
Which is bwbrocate@gibney.com. They can visit me on our website, which is gibney.com, and they'll see the full breadth of the personnel we have devoted to fighting infringements, and they'll see exactly what types of cases that we get involved in. So probably, Ken, the best way to start is a visit to our website and then a reach out to whichever attorney in our group you feel will most effectively deal with your particular problem.
Brian, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure as always.
Well, Ken, thank you so much for making your part of me part of your program. And, of course, thank you for all the support over the years. And you've been a wonderful colleague and continue to be.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Ken. So I promised you to tell you more about Alibaba. And we focus on the fakes and counterfeit products on Alibaba. Alibaba actually is comprised of a couple of different sites. One of the sites is Alibaba.com, and another one is Taobao, Taobao.com. And there's a recent article on CNN Money that suggests that about 80% of the articles and goods found on Taobao are counterfeit products. And from my own experience, I would say it could be true that even on Alibaba.com, a similar thing is true. I mean, if you are, for example, searching on Alibaba for, let's say, Nike and at the same time for Adidas, so you put both names in the search box, you will find plenty of hits where you get vendors in China telling you that you can, you know, just order shoes there and they just put any label on the shoes that you would like. So this is a pretty big problem, and Alibaba is trying to fight the fakes, at least on paper. And you can file a takedown request for any of the goods listed on Alibaba or Taobao, and then they will be removed, likely removed. But the problem is that it's just the sheer number of articles listed there. So in the first 10 months of 2013, Taobao alone removed 114 million product listings. So you just have to, you know, see this sheer number. I mean, it's 114 million product listings from Taobao. That's by far more than on Amazon or eBay. So this is really a big problem, and now they are listed in the US, and now people might be able to sue Taobao or Alibaba more easily because of the fake products. So if you want to learn more about this story, you can just head over to the show notes, and I'll have the link in the show notes to this particular article on CNN Money. And with that, I say goodbye, and I hope you listen to us next time.
That's it for this episode. If you liked what you heard, please show us your love by visiting ipfridays.com/love and tweet a link to this show. We would be so grateful if you would do that. It would help us out to get the word out. Also, please subscribe to our podcast at ipfridays.com or on iTunes or Stitcher.com. If you have a question or want to be featured in one of the upcoming episodes, please send us your feedback at ipfridays.com/feedback. Also, please leave us a review on iTunes. You can go to ipfridays.com/iTunes, and it will take you right to the correct page on iTunes. If you want to get mentioned on this podcast or even have comments within the next episode, please leave us your voicemail at ipfridays.com/voicemail. You have been listening to an episode of IP Fridays. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by their respective law firms. None of the content should be considered legal advice. The IP Fridays podcast should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The contents of this podcast are intended for general informational purposes only, and you are urged to consult your own lawyer on any specific legal questions. As always, consult a lawyer or patent or trademark attorney. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved.